Support for the show comes from Atlassian. Atlassian software like Jira, Confluence, and Loom help power the collaboration needed for teams to accomplish what would otherwise be impossible alone. Because individually, we're great, but together, we're so much better. That's why millions of teams around the world, including 75% of the Fortune 500, trust Atlassian software for everything from space exploration and green energy to delivering pizzas and podcasts. Whether you're a team of 2, 200, or 2 million, Atlassian software is built to help keep you connected and moving together as one. Learn how to unleash the potential of your team at Atlassian.com. That's Atlassian.com. Atlassian.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to help you plan that unbelievable travel experience. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Welcome to the Prop G Pod's Office Hours. This is the part of the show where we answer your questions about business, big tech, entrepreneurship, and whatever else is on your mind. If you'd like to submit a question, please email a voice recording to officehours@propgmedia.com. Again, that's officehours@propgmedia.com. First question.
Hi, Prop G. Tim Trattoria here. I'm a CFO in network TV production, and I recently heard you talking about a $25 minimum wage. I generally think the idea of a minimum wage bankrupting businesses is BS and a scare tactic. But at the same time, a high national minimum wage that moves the needle in metropolitan America will spike inflation and kill jobs in small market America. It seems to me that the market solves for wages. And if you force a $25 wage nationally, West Virginia, for example, will forever be left in poverty because it can't compete on lower costs to increase jobs. And in New York City, it likely won't even move the needle for most people. I think minimum wage should be indexed the way the GSA does for federal employees, housing reimbursement, or per diems. A $25 minimum wage is a nuclear bomb swatting a pesky fly instead of a fly swatter that is more surgical. Does your thinking have more nuance, or is it just as simple as $25 nationally and figure it out?
Tim, thanks for the thoughtful question. Minimum wage is something I'm thinking a lot about recently. If minimum wage had kept pace with productivity gains since 1968, it would be above 20 bucks. I think it'd be about $23 right now. So the minimum wage from 1968 wasn't kind of hammering these lower income states. Having said that, I think there's some merit to what you're saying. And that is a more nuanced approach would be to say, okay, what is the poverty line in every state? Because you need less to live in West Virginia than you need in, say, the Bay Area. And then maybe index it to that and say, this is the minimum wage across different states, or the minimum wage is a calculation based on the cost of living there. And we're going to decide that if anyone works 40 plus hours a week, they should not live below the poverty line. That might be a means of marking or identifying what the analysis is. So I think you're right. I think that we don't want, it's going to take more than one type of hammer. The problem is, if you were to start doing that, I see it getting out of control and everyone inserting their own language into the types, the calculus. And the states that have implemented higher minimum wage, despite cries of all these businesses going out of business, what they found is the economy has actually grown. Why? Because the wonderful thing about lower and middle income people who would mostly benefit from an increase in minimum wage is when you give them a dollar, they spend it all. And when you give a wealthy person a dollar, they invest it, which takes down interest rates, takes up the market, and there's some advantage there. But most of those benefits accrue to the top 10%, if not the top 1%, who own 90% of stocks and bonds. So just some data about minimum wage. When it's adjusted for inflation, it's at its lowest level in 66 years. And the $25 minimum wage threshold has been tried. 10 cities in California, including Los Angeles, have either passed or introduced a $25 minimum wage for healthcare workers, which is kind of interesting. By mid-August, the share of searches for $25 an hour jobs on Indeed, the job site, was up 120% year on year and surpassed the share of searches for $15 an hour. The UC Berkeley Labor Center found that low wages cost taxpayers $100 billion annually. Lower wages equals a greater dependence on social programs including SNAP and Medicaid. And some, you're going to pay for poor people one way or the other. We found the $700 billion to bail out the richest cohort in America, small business people, with PPP. We found $600 billion to $1 trillion to provide debt relief to the third of Americans that got to go to college, but we don't want to increase minimum wage. I think a big step to address mental health issues in this country is to give people a sense of purpose. And nothing gives you a sense of purpose like a job. Would certain companies go out of business? Yes. Would certain consumer stocks get hammered? Yes. Would this solve homelessness? Would this solve depression? Would this solve obesity? Would this solve kids living in poverty? No, but it would help all of them. And stocks going down and consumer companies getting hammered and some businesses going out of business, it would be worth it. And also, I think we just need to get people back to work in a dignified way. We have to say to them, working is awesome. This is America. We work. That's one thing I've always noticed about America is that we work harder. But there's no reason why the wealthiest country in the world shouldn't pay better than any. What's the point of being the wealthiest nation in the world? Wouldn't the most basic litmus test be how much do you pay your least well-compensated employees? And I was on the board of a retailer, and the CEO used to say, well, we let supply and demand sort out the labor market, because we used to get a lot of shit for not paying our frontline employees in our 550 stores a good wage. And I did say this. I said, when you totally rely on this kind of Milton Friedman labor market based on supply and demand, you end up with 1 in 5 households have food insecure kids. The market fails around low-wage households, and we need to move in. It would be a better multiplier effect. They would spend all of it. They would spend all of it. There's not a lot of evidence that it destroys businesses. As a matter of fact, the economies and job growth has increased in nations with higher minimum wage, and just bringing it back to where it was in 1968 would be $23 a share. I'd love to see a candidate run on this, but let me circle back. Noted. It probably requires some more nuance at a state level. I hate getting into this though, because it immediately becomes a political football. And I think it would be easier just to have a federally mandated minimum wage that gave people dignity of work. Thank you for the question, Tim. Next question.
Hey, Scott. It's Jeff from Chicago. Best city in the world, 9 months of the year. Really like your new Markets Focus podcast each week. Here's my question. My business partner and I have bootstrapped our fintech venture out of personal funds the last 18 months. Development and betas are complete, and now ready to add some gas. While we're still pre-revenue, we have high confidence in our business model. We would strongly prefer to bring in expansion capital via venture debt or loans instead of venture capital. We're talking less than $3 million, and we're new to the process. So where would you advise a new company like ours find access to debt and creditors? The problem we're facing is that to get traditional debt financing through a bank, we have to show 12 to 24 months of revenue. But we're not going to get there without expansion capital first. Anyway, love to hear your riff on our situation. Thanks, Scott.
Jeff, in Chicago, I was in Chicago about 12 hours ago. I connected from Las Vegas through Chicago to get to London. I haven't slept in about 28 hours. I could start hallucinating any moment. I feel okay right now. I'm in that sort of mania phase when you don't sleep. But I was in Chicago, or specifically, I was at O'Hare for about 2 hours. Whenever I'm at O'Hare, I do what you do when you're in Rome, and I have McDonald's, which is my favorite airport meal. Anyways, not what you were asking. So I don't think you're going to be able to get debt. I think your company's too early. And typically venture debt from a Silicon Valley bank or Comerica oftentimes follows venture financing. Why? Because people think venture capitalists are smarter than them. And if they've invested $20 million in equity, that if they give you $3 or $5 million in venture debt, that it should be safe, because venture debt sits higher in the cap structure. What do I mean by that? If your business goes out of business, if it goes bankrupt, hopefully there's some asset value there, the IP, some of the business relationships, whatever it might be. There's some assets, the computers you have, maybe you have a great lease or you bought your office, whatever it is. And the creditors, the debtors, get to show up and get claim to those assets before the equity. So what Comerica does, when I started a company called L2 and General Catalyst put $15 million, I think, into our Series B, Comerica just shows up and says, if a tier one VC such as General Catalyst has invested $15 million, we'll give you $5 million in venture debt. And we didn't need the cash, but the terms were something like 3.25% with some warrant coverage. And I said, send it over and I'll sign it and fax it back because it felt like nearly free money. So there are some big players in venture debt, but typically they follow an equity round or, as you said, financials that say this company is a good credit risk on its own. They bypass that evaluation, that diligence, when a great VC has come in because they trust the VC's diligence. So I think you're going to have a tough time getting debt. I also think you should consider perhaps bringing in outside capital. It sounds like you have the type of business that might be kind of capital consumptive. But I think the right VC, a couple $1 million in financing, then maybe $1 million in venture debt, get some good people on your board that have some domain expertise, can help you build the company, have been there before. One of the guys on my board, Larry Bond at from General Catalyst, Larry just has this sort of sixth sense around how many people should be in each department. He can look at our costs and see where we're spending too much or where we're investing too little. He just has a feel for value creation and capital formation. And a good VC has just seen a lot. They can also bring some enterprise value, not as much as they advertise, but they can help you with recruiting. They can help you with some HR-related issues. They can help do a search for key positions. But for the most part, it's all about the individual. Anyways, long-winded way of saying, I don't think you're going to be successful finding debt based on what I knew about your company. I would consider doing a small equity raise if your company is doing as well as it sounds like it's doing, and then maybe top it up with some venture debt. Thanks very much for the question, Jeff. We have one quick break before our final question. Stay with us.
Support for the show comes from Betterment. Even the most hardcore of us need to kick back and chill every now and then. But if you're an investor, chill is the last thing you want your money to be doing. You want it to be pumping iron and running marathons for you. If you want your money performing at an Olympic level, you might want to check out Betterment's automated investment and savings app. Betterment's automated technology gives you advanced tools that are built to help maximize returns. Tools like diversified, expert-built portfolios of low-cost ETFs, high-yield cash accounts, and automated investing technology, including automated rebalancing. Plus, Betterment can help with tax-efficient investing. Strategies including their Tax Loss Harvesting Plus and Asset Location can help minimize your taxes and maximize your returns. So whether you're saving or investing, your money should be working as hard as it possibly can for you. Consider Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. You can visit Betterment.com to get started. You can learn more about high-yield cash accounts at Betterment.com. Investing involves risk. Performance not guaranteed. Cash reserve offered through Betterment LLC and Betterment Securities. Betterment is not a bank.
Support for Prop G comes from NerdWallet. You don't have to be a genius to start making better financial decisions today. It's not that sexy, but piling up lots of little monetary victories today can yield some pretty significant rewards down the line. The tricky part is knowing where to start. NerdWallet can help. Their financial experts have helped countless people find ways to maximize every dollar they earn. Now, the team is helping folks get more from every dollar they spend. NerdWallet lets you compare top travel credit cards side by side to maximize your spending, some even offering up to 10 times the points on every dollar you charge. Their expert team of nerds do the work reviewing top credit cards so you can trust you have the smartest one for future you. If I had better rewards right now, I'd probably upgrade my hotel at South by Southwest so I could have a big fat party and everyone would be impressed and love me. Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel credit card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at NerdWallet.com. NerdWallet. Finance smarter. Reminder, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. Welcome back. Question number three.
Hi, Scott. I'm calling from Swansea on the edge of the Gower Peninsula. Great place to visit if you're coming to the UK. My question's about getting on the property ladder, and it's like 8 times annual income in the UK, maybe 5 times in America. So getting a deposit together is kind of hard, right? So shouldn't renters get some kind of equity or property asset for their rental payments that they are paying? So can we reconstruct it? And I was thinking, if you take the rental payments and have it guaranteed, you insure them, the renter does that, maybe with some non-adversarial insurance company like what Lemonade has done, That's a B Corp insurance, not like these greedy insurance companies, then their rent's guaranteed for 6 months, right? So why shouldn't they get some of the upside of that property? In the UK, we've had like lease to buy, rent to buy schemes, which have the governments have set up for like, you know, nurses and critical workers to help them get on the property ladder. Surely it's time to stack the capital markets and the property markets in favor of the next generation. And is there a way to do this? Can DAOs help achieve this? Can smart technology help achieve this? Thanks for my question. You've got a great show. And oh, that's okay.
Paolo from Swansea, thanks for the thoughtful question. First off, kind of what should happen is a bit moot. It's sort of what is. Everybody should have access to a roof and shelter. And ideally, it's a fantastic way over time. If you look at it as an asset class, it usually doesn't overperform other asset classes, but it's a great forced savings mechanism because you don't want to get evicted from your house. So you make that payment and you slowly but surely pay down your mortgage. Time takes over. You've lived somewhere 10 or 15 years. Most real estate that you hold for a long time survives cycles, and you end up with something that's worth a lot of money because you've had four savings and it's compounded and you've gotten to enjoy it along the way. So I've made good money in real estate. I think I've made money on almost every house I've owned, but maybe that's a function of I bought my first house in 1994 or 95. You can't participate in the real estate market without owning a home. You can invest in REITs or real estate stocks. So there's different ways to take advantage of appreciation in real estate. It is outrageous that mortgage interest is tax deductible and rent isn't. Who owns homes? Old people. Who rents homes? Young people. Everything we do around tax policy is meant to do one thing, and that's transfer money from people under the age of 40 who have seen their wealth as a percentage of GDP go from 19% to 9% in the last 40 years, such that old people, seniors 65 plus, are 72% wealthier than they were just 40 years ago, right? The wealthiest cohort in the history of the planet, baby boomers and seniors in America, get $1.5 trillion transferred to them each year from young people in the form of Social Security. I'm not suggesting we let seniors starve. You make over a certain amount of money or have a certain amount of assets, you should not be getting Social Security full stop. And people say, well, I paid into it. No, it's called Social Security tax, not Social Security pension. Anyways, bit of a rant. I can't get over how expensive housing has become for people your age. So you either move to a lower cost area or you start investing in REITs. But I don't think what you're talking about is politically palatable. So just some stats here. Homeowners' median net worth is, get this, 80 times larger than renters' median net worth. A homeowner who purchased a single family home 10 years ago would have gained on average almost $250,000 in equity if they'd sold for the median price today. There is a startup doing something similar to what you're suggesting, Up and Up. Renters get a return on the profits of the rent that they pay. And if the value of the property they're renting goes up, the returns increase as well. They can use the proceeds to make a down payment on a home or cash out at the end of their lease. But the bottom line is home ownership has become increasingly unattainable for young people because of economic policies that continue to transfer wealth from young people to old people. And also this bullshit, rejectionist, NIMBYist culture we've created in the United States, where once we have a college degree, we love that admissions rates go down such that our degree from UCLA or MIT or Georgia Tech continues to gain in value because it's more scarce. Once we have a tech company that's successful, we begin immediately filing all sorts of patents and putting our elbows out and giving money to politicians and senators that will try and squash competition. Again, more rejectionist, NIMBYist. And even worse, once we own a home, we start showing up for local civic board meetings or planning or architectural review boards and make it impossible for new development. Because once you have a home, you want less supply, such that the price of homes go up. What does this mean? Young people have to pay increasingly exorbitant prices for college, for houses, and also to start businesses. It's total bullshit. America is about as much opportunity to as many unremarkable people as possible. That was a bit of a rant. Anyways, save money, live below your means, invest in real estate stocks until you have a down payment for your own home. Thanks for the question, Paolo from Swansea. That's awesome, Paolo from Swansea. Well done. That's all for this episode. Again, if you'd like to submit a question, please email a voice recording to officehours@propgmedia.com. Our producers are Caroline Chagrin, Claire Miller, and Drew Burrows. Sammy Resnick is our associate producer. If you like what you heard, please follow, download, and subscribe. Thank you for listening to the Prof G Pod from the Vox Media Podcast Network. We will catch you next week.